prayer quest. I am Father Thomas Dubé, Marist priest, based in St. Paul, Minnesota. My job for the last 20 years approximately has been full-time on the road giving lectures and retreats and mini courses, mostly to religious brothers and sisters and priests, but also to lay people. We are beginning in this program a new series, and the series, as you notice, is called Prayer Quest. We're going to be working, developing, deepening what it means to have a deep immersion in God and what are the conditions of it happening. You will recall, some of you anyhow, that we have had a series on contemplation, which deals with the same sort of subject, but this one is going to expand it and to deepen it, and we are not going to repeat what we did in the other series, the previous one. Good people, sincere people, I find in this retreat work and the courses that I give, invariably want to know more about a deep immersion in God. As a matter of fact, I remember one recent lay retreat where we spent a weekend on this sort of subject. Could not do very much in a weekend, but anyhow, we covered some. And the immediate reaction of the group, which was oversubscribed, the retreat was oversubscribed by quite a bit, was, can we have more? And so immediately they booked another retreat. People in our day, not all by a long shot, but many, are really, you could say fed up if you want, take a milder word if you wish, but disappointed at least in the materialism of our age, know that they're not satisfied with what they can put their hands on, and they want something that is meaningful, eternally meaningful. And we're going to delve into that subject in this series. We can take a look at the visuals that we have on the set here, and I'll say just a few words about each of them to get a feel for where we're going. Our thirst for God. I'm going to begin with the idea that we don't even speak of God right away. We have, as human persons, a voracious thirst, which I'm going to explain. And everybody has it, atheist as well as theist. And after we talk about that, we will notice that it really is a thirst for the infinite, God himself. Then we're going to discuss impediments to the quenching. Quenching doesn't happen automatically. Just as if you are thirsty in a natural sense, you don't quench the thirst until you drink the drink. It doesn't happen automatically, the quenching. And so we will say a few things about impediments to quenching. Then we are going to look at a third area, which will be wonder and human fulfillment and enrichment. And you will notice that these subjects, by the way, are seldom talked about, almost never. To the general public, but they're most basic to the human situation. And a human being is alive intellectually and volitionally, mind and will, to the extent that this individual wonders, responds to reality, is alive. We'll say a few words about that. Then we will deal with leisure, work, and fulfillment. And leisure here, as we shall explain, is not simply time off, stopping work. Leisure has very rich connotations. It's a kind of drinking of reality and in being fulfilled in the very drinking itself. So we will have quite a bit to say about that. Then our next area shall be meditation as leading to contemplation. Meditation is the human input, reading something, maybe looking at a gorgeous sunset, reflecting on implications of it, leading one to God, but done all in a human manner. And that leads, as we grow, to contemplation, which is a deepening immersion in God that he gives. We talked about that in the previous series. And so I won't say a whole lot except to kind of recap and summarize contemplation. Then we will take a notice, not very extended, but we will ask about Oriental approaches. Oriental contemplation. I would prefer to speak of Oriental awareness because it is very different from our subject. And so we will take a little look at that many people think that that's the way to go for immersion in God, we will notice that not all Oriental approaches even are concerned with God. Some are, but many are not. Then we will take a look at this marvelous woman, Saint Teresa of Avila, marvelous in more ways than I can say right here. But one idea she had, namely that every single person, she was a cloistered nun, a Carmelite nun, but nonetheless she had a great understanding of lay life. She had many lay friends. She loved them dearly. She loved her own family dearly. And she knew lay life extremely well. Of course, all of us are laymen before we become priests or religious. I've been a layman too. We'll take a look at St. Teresa on the one point, namely that every single one of us, no matter who you might be, every one of us is called to this deep immersion in God, this deep communion that we call contemplation. Then we shall look at the next area, namely prayer and time pressures. Because of all the reasons people will give that they can't have time for contemplation, they are so busy they just can't do this sort of thing. It might be all right for nuns and monks, priests and bishops maybe, but lay people couldn't possibly have the opportunity for contemplation, and so many people just kind of write it off entirely. We'll talk about that again at some length. And then finally, we will take a look at what Scripture says about prayer and lifestyle, because a communion with God is not independent of how we live. Just as a communion between a husband and a wife is not just nice words toward one another, it's very much conditioned by the lifestyle each one lives. So that if a husband says to his wife, with all warmth, "I love you, darling, with my whole life," and then is selfish in the details of human life, he's trying to kid himself. And maybe his wife, but she'd be perceptive enough to know that's not the way things are. And so also, if we want this deep immersion with God, we've got to live a certain lifestyle. Authentic is one word that describes it well. We are ready now for taking a look at our first area of discussion, our thirst for God. As I intimated, suggested a few moments ago, every single human being, not only theists, but atheists, every man, every woman, intelligent, dull, aged, young, middle-aged, of all nationalities, all cultures, everybody has a deep thirst. We'll get to the God part of it in just a few moments. And I want to explain that idea that every human being, you and I included, therefore, have this profound thirst for God. And I want to show you in a number of ways that it is so. We are at the very roots now at what it is to be human. Why are we on the planet? We are different from camels and giraffes and amoebas. What in the world are we doing? You could not get more relevant than the question we're raising right now. Each of us is a gaping hunger, even voraciously a gaping hunger for infinity. We can't help it. No other on this planet yearns for fullness, infinity, as we do. It's our glory, and it's our poverty. It's our glory in the sense that because spirit in the flesh, more about that shortly, we can never be content with finite things, and you never have been content with them, as I'll explain shortly. That's our glory. You cannot say this of any other living being on the planet but the human being. But it's our poverty too, because the other side of that coin is that we can't be fulfilled by ourselves. And we have to be fulfilled by the only infinite there is, that is God Himself. Now, that brings us to my explaining why you are voraciously hungry for God. Even if you should happen to be an atheist and you deny God, "I have no hunger for Him whatsoever," someone might even say, "I despise Him." I'm saying you still have this hunger for infinity, and it can be found nowhere else. And I'm going to give you no less than 6 different ways of explaining why you are this hunger. First, let's talk about your experience. Pick the best day of your life. I could certainly make the point easily by picking the worst day of your life. Let's pick the best day you can think of. A day that you anticipated maybe for months, even for years. It finally turns up. It might have been seeing a dear friend. It might have been possibly an exciting trip that you were planning. It might have been a glitzy party, possibly. But pick your best day. Now, you will notice after that day, and suppose everything went very well with the day, no problems with it, you'll notice if you give yourself the time to ponder quietly. Most people don't want to ponder quietly. That's part of our problem. But suppose at 2 a.m. in the morning, you're alone, it's quiet, you will notice welling up in your deep person center a feeling, more or less explicitly, is that all there is? I felt it. I'm pretty sure if you ever get yourself into solitude long enough to ponder the human situation, I'm sure you felt it too. You've experienced your finitude and your need for infinity, that the very best day of your life left you feeling, is that all there is? The second example from your experience is that you felt your finitude whenever you were severely criticized, especially by a dear one, and this person really cut you down. The bottom seems to fall out of your life. Or if you fail miserably at something, even publicly maybe, the bottom seems to fall out. Or you lose a close friend, or your marriage falls apart. You felt your finitude acutely. Mere animals can't feel that, and they don't. They can feel physical pain. They can feel a kind of disappointment when your friendly little dog sees you leave and closes the door. You close the door, and your little dog knows you're gone all day. The little dog has a kind of sadness, all right, but does not have any of this bottom falling out, this experience of finitude that I'm talking about. The third kind of experience that points this out is your disillusionment with pleasure, the emptiness that it leaves you with. And by pleasure, I'm referring now to sense pleasures, not a real delight in beauty and truth and goodness and God. I'm talking about sense pleasures. You will notice that in sense delights, if you repeat them over and over again, they become less. Usually, at least, they become less. And even a jadedness sets in. Let me use an example that makes the point for me. When I was in high school, our class had a picnic, and one of the highlights of the picnic in my mind was that we had 5 gallons of ice cream, and we were told that we could eat all the ice cream we wanted. And I'm rather ashamed of myself, and I did. I ate so much ice cream that by the time mid-afternoon came by, I didn't like ice cream anymore, at least not that day. One can get disgusted with sense pleasures. This is why people jazz them up, change them, try to make them more than they were, or in sexual matters, new partner, new technique, new something or other, that they get jaded and disillusioned with their pleasures, whatever it happens to be. That is because we are infinite in our spirit, and nothing on a sense level can satisfy completely. If it ever did, you would stop with one experience. Isaiah 29, verse 8, makes the point well. We shall be like the hungry man who dreams he eats and wakes with empty belly, like the thirsty person who dreams he drinks and wastes exhausted, his throat parched. The final experience of your finitude is the facing of death. Death looms large on your horizon and mine, even if you are a youngster. You're not long for this life. It doesn't last very long. And this is one reason we sanitize death, and we don't want to talk about it, and we don't want to face it, because it's unpleasant for a person who is not deeply immersed in God. And we feel how finite we are, how helpless we are before the fact of death looming large on our horizon. And by death looming large, I mean to include the consequences of it, the consequences of the grave as well. Now, the second way, that's our first way of showing that we are this incarnated thirst nothing finite ever satisfies. Now, our second way of making this point is to borrow a thought from Dostoevsky, the Russian novelist, probably the best novelist of the whole century, 19th century. In one of his books, and Dostoevsky, you know, wrote extensively about the human person and God, and he examined atheism in fine detail, more brilliant in exposing atheism than any atheist I've read. But Dostoevsky was a most devout theist, but brilliant. Any event, he put on the lips of one of his characters, I quote, "To live without God is nothing but torture. Man cannot live without kneeling. If he rejects God, he kneels before an idol of wood or of gold or an imaginary one. They are all idolaters and not atheists. That's what they ought to be called." Dostoevsky is saying that the human person, being what we are, the human person is going to worship something. That's for sure. If it's not the real God, it will be pleasure or prestige or power or money or maybe all of these things. But everybody worships something. Because we are this incarnated thirst, we've got to make something absolute in our lives. And everybody does. So, it's either the real God, or it's some finite thing that we make into a God. And that is why Dostoevsky says they should be called idolaters. There are really, in this sense, no atheists in existence. Everybody has an absolute. Even those who deny absolutes do. The third way I want to show you that we are incarnated thirsts comes from a psychotherapist, C.A. Jung. And he made the remark toward the last half of his life, and I don't know why he exactly made it into two halves, but he made the remark that he had not met anybody who's got a problem, emotional, psychological problem, whose difficulty was not basically lacking what religion provides. Very, very interesting remark, something to think about. If I lack love, beauty, joy, I'm going to have a problem of some type or other. And I'm pretty sure that's what C.A. Jung meant. I saw just a few days ago in the press an example of what Jung was driving at. An article said that Sweden, which is, as you know, a wealthy country, very high standard of living, and also an extremely permissive society, Sweden has a suicide rate 1,000 times that of Haiti, which is an extremely poor country, destitute, just about the poorest in the world. Notice that. One of the very wealthiest in the world has a suicide rate 1,000 times higher than just about the poorest country. And making the point that I'm pretty sure C.A. Jung had in mind. The fourth way I want to make this point, we have six in case you're wondering. You experience that you are spirit in the flesh kind of being. I want to be here a little bit philosophical. Not difficult, but a little bit of philosophy. Spirit as such, which is distinguished from matter, has no parts, no extension, no weight, no quantity. Spirit breaks beyond all material boundaries. It has to. And you can never fill spirit with things that are finite, limited, merely created. If I were to take, it would take far more than me to do it, but if people were to agree to take and try to fill a football stadium with grains of sand and one grain per century, it would take trillions of centuries, of course, to fill the football stadium. But in principle, it could be filled because the stadium is material, and the grains of sand are material. Nothing finite, no matter how long you live, can fill your being. And I've given you reasons why we experience that. And that's because we are spirit beings, spirit in the flesh. Time magazine had an article a couple years ago, and its title was, "Do Humans Need to Get High?" Very interesting title in our day. And it dealt with a book whose title was, "Intoxication, Life in Pursuit of Artificial Paradise." Also, very interesting idea, and highly pertinent to the subject we're dealing with at the moment. The author of this book offered two contentions. The first was that by nature, human persons seek highs, and they have this need for highs in the current sense of the term. By nature, they have it. As we need, and by nature, we seek water for thirst or other drinks, and food for hunger. And we've got this man was maintaining in his book, does maintain in it, that same natural need for highs. His second contention was that because drugs and alcohol taken to excess, cocaine and heroin and so on, because they damage the human person, his second contention was that society, and I quote here, should launch an all-out effort to invent less damaging substitutes for alcohol, heroin, cocaine. This author has his finger on a truth, a basic truth, that human beings, in their very natures, have to have much more than creation can afford. He's mistaken in knowing what the solution is. The fifth way I want to make this point is a very different kind of literary form. It's a cartoon. Some of you may remember the cartoon. I have not seen it recently. Maybe it's been discontinued. But it was called The Small Society. And there was a little character in it who would make observations about human life, sometimes highly insightful. And I have before me one of these cartoons in two panels. And in the first one, this little individual with a very worried look on his face is looking over his shoulder toward the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. And I think the idea is to give a kind of feel that we expect material welfare from the government. And he makes this remark with that worried look on his face. "Some of us don't know what we want." Then in the second panel, he turns away toward the reader. So the first, "Some of us don't know what we want, but feel pretty sure we don't have it." He's put his finger right on the target. We all of us know we don't have this complete fulfillment as human persons. And I've given several reasons how we know this, and how it can be expressed. Some people know where the solution is, and some do not. And the cartoon makes that point indeed well. It's uncanny how St. Paul made this very point in his first letter to the Corinthians in chapter 2. He said, "Eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor can it enter the heart of man." There's nothing like it in visible creation. "What God has prepared for those who love him." And of course, God has prepared himself. And there's nothing that you can imagine, nothing you have seen, nothing you have heard, nothing you have experienced that will satisfy your heart. And Paul is right on target with the right answer to the question. In his letter to the Ephesians in chapter 3, St. Paul speaks of this fulfillment in God. Praying, kneeling before the Father and praying. Maybe this is one of your favorite sections in the New Testament. He prays that Christ will fill us and live in our hearts, planted and built on love, and that we will with the saints have the strength to grasp the breadth and the length and the height and the depth, no limit to Christ's love. And then Paul says, "Until you are filled with the utter fullness of Christ." fullness of God. That is the solution. Now, the sixth and final way in which I wish to make this point, that each of us is an incarnated thirst, and for God, He's the only infinite, from Scripture. Isaiah 55, O come to the fountain, all you who are thirsty. Though you have no money, come. Why spend money on what is not bread, your wages on what fails to satisfy? Come, listen to me, and your soul shall live. Nothing of finite order, says Isaiah, will satisfy you. Come to the fountain, capital F, God Himself. Or, as Psalm 42 puts it, as a deer longs for running waters, so my soul longs for you, my God. A thirst is my soul for God, the living God. That says it beautifully and marvelous imagery, that if you have a deer that's been on the chase for a long time, very thirsty, and comes to the running waters, clear, cold, and as that deer is longing for the solution to the thirst, so my soul is longing for you, my God. Or as Psalm 63 puts it, O God, you are my God whom I seek. For you my flesh pines, and my soul thirsts like the earth, parched, lifeless, and without water. Just as a desert, if it were human and could will and know, would thirst for the rains, so we who do know and can know are thirsts for God in the flesh. And if we see Him as He really is, if we're on the right path, we will find our quenching in Him. Next time we will take up, still with our thirst for God, and complete that discussion. God bless you.